Welcome to the Immigrant Stories Program. Kathleen Fitzsimmons has spent her career working with children in the town she grew up in, Leadville, Colorado. Over the past 26 years, she's been a teacher, an instructional coach, an assistant principal, a principal, and a human resources director. But in her free time, Kathleen has created another career for herself as historian of Leadville's mining history. Kathleen devoted her master's degree to the study of Leadville's role in the early development of Colorado. Along the way, she met James Walsh, professor of political science at the University of Colorado, Denver. Their friendship and collaboration over the years was a key element in the development of Leadville's Irish Miners Memorial, which was dedicated in September of last year. Over 500 people from across Colorado were joined in the celebration by the Irish ambassador to the United States and a delegation from Alahees, Leadville's sister city on Ireland's Barra Peninsula. Welcome to the Immigrant Stories Program. It's an honor and a privilege to have you here, and I want to start by just thanking you for what you've done to shed light on all the people, all the immigrants who've made Leadville this really dynamic community.
Thank you very much for having me. It definitely is not a sole effort, and because of so many people who have put their heart and soul into raising the story of the immigrants who shaped Leadville, that we've been able to do the things we have, and it's been great to be a part of that group.
So I want to find out more about your journey and your path and what you led you here.
Well, good question. I had a little bit of a unique childhood in that I'm the youngest child of nine, and I have eight older brothers. And so we had a crew at my house, and it was a lovely, busy, bustling place. And my mom and I were the only females. And that meant a lot of different interesting gender roles, but also opportunities to push myself to keep up with the guys all the time and compete with them or compliment them in whatever their skills might be. You know, my brothers are it's a very diverse group of really interesting characters. And so there was never a dull moment at our dinner table or in the backyard. We are the third generation of people of our family to be born in Leadville. Okay, and our daughters are the fourth generation to be born up here. I unfortunately didn't get to graduate high school or be raised up here, as my father, who worked for the mine, for Climax Mine, got transferred down to Golden. So I graduated from Evergreen High School, went to school in Chicago, and then came back up to Leadville when I graduated college. And so childhood was a lot of Evergreen, but then coming up to Leadville as often as we could to see our grandparents. And we still had a lot of dear friends up here that we would knock around the woods with.
So your mother must have heaved a sigh of relief when you finally showed up.
I don't know if she was happy or sad when I
arrived. Oh, I'm sure she was happy. No, I know. My mother had four boys.
Oh, there you go. Yes.
She would have, loved to have had a daughter.
Yes. She was my best friend growing up. Huh. I think that while she was intimidated at the notion of raising a daughter, it ended up being an absolutely wonderful friendship and collaboration that she and I had. And she is an incredible woman. She's still alive. She'll turn 90 next month. And we'll get as many of the kids back together as we can to honor her, because she is she's a force of nature.
You grew up in Leadville and love it deeply. I'm wondering about your master's degree is even part of your love for this place.
It is. After I got done with college in Chicago at Northwestern University, I knew when I moved back here and moved into my grandparents' house up on West 7th Street that I wanted to learn more about the place. And they had recently died, and I was very aware as to how my connections to the past were literally dying out, and I wanted to preserve them. And so I was able to create a master's degree in frontier mining history with a focus on the family stories and the legends of Leadville. And it was a blast to research. I started with geology and ended with ghost stories.
Wow.
And it was really fun. And it's been then transformative in terms of leading groups on the east side of Leadville, or the way in which I taught my history classes, or how we raise our kids. You know, it's definitely had its fingerprints everywhere.
Growing up, you were Irish in a big way, mm-hmm. right? Were both sides, were your dad was Irish?
So my dad is Irish. My mother is Hungarian.
Oh.
And so her dad immigrated from Budapest, and he was a Hungarian Jew. And then he married an English-German woman in Long Island. And they were a wonderful team. He was a bit of an inventor, and they owned a chocolate factory, of all things, on Long Island. And then my dad and mother met in Connecticut. My dad was in the Coast Guard, and he brought her to Leadville. She was I don't know if she was trained in chemistry or physics.
Wow.
Her and her siblings, they all had very impressive degrees for the time, certainly. And they came to Leadville. And so we had a stronger presence of the Irish Catholic heritage, because we're in the town where my father's family was.
Right.
My mother's side was still influential in different ways. And I think that as I get older and I'm more aware of how oftentimes a woman's lineage and history is lost to her children, I want to resurrect that and pay attention to it as well as my father's side.
You talked about in Leadville, our demographic has always been a community of immigrants.
Yeah, Leadville was created by immigrants and continues to be a rich and interesting place because of immigrants. When it was a mining town, you could walk down Harrison or State or Chestnut Street and hear probably five or six different languages. Underground was the same thing. You had a lot of immigrants working at both underground and then in the service industry. And we are still a community of immigrants, with a lot of recent folks moving from Central and South America, a little further back from Mexico. And I think that diversity has added to the strength and the richness of Leadville
I value. What were the 1870s, 1880s? What was the diversity then? There were a lot of Irish.
But great question. Yes. So the Irish were the biggest demographic. On the east side, you had the Irish. North of town, you had Italians. On the other side, sort of in West 2nd Street, you would have the Slovenians. Up on the hill, you would have English. And then we have little pockets of different, like little villages. Like one is a little town called Cleadermore, which was named after Cleadermore Gulch in England. We have Adelaide Park, a stump town where we had Polish and German immigrants. And so there were, you know, sort of like in New York City or some major city where you have different ethnic neighborhoods, Leadville had that as well.
Were the Irish, were they singled out, or were, you know, prejudice was towards immigrants has been around since forever?
Since forever, there's been immigrants and xenophobia. The Irish were targeted for sure. Unfortunately, in Colorado at that time, the rise of the KKK was occurring, and there was an anti-Irish, anti-Catholic sentiment. And the Irish, being the largest ethnic group of immigrants in Leadville, were denied a lot of the you know, equality in terms of access to political power or economic advantages or things like that. So there was the widespread discrimination certainly was not, the Irish were not spared in that at all.
What was the hierarchy? Who was in charge, large and in charge?
Yeah, large and in charge tended to be the English Protestant owners of the means of production. And then they may have, some of their managers often were Cornish, in between.
Why Cornish? Why?
They, from the mines in Cornwall, they had an excellent, especially in the mines, they had a great understanding of what it took to be a mine manager and the nuances of mining and the incredibly sophisticated math and geology needed to figure out how to chase this vein or that vein and pump out the water and keep the mines just safe enough to be profitable. I don't know how that balance is.
Yeah, I was about to ask, what were conditions like?
Working conditions were horrific in the mines. From 1880s up through the strikes of 1896, the miners were continuing to try to get a $3 a day wage. After the silver crash of 1893, it went down to $2.50. Whereas their peers in Butte, for example, might be making $5 or $6 a day. Here they weren't. And so the compensation was minimal. There is no sick leave. There's no insurance. You are working down underground with explosives by candlelight, mostly breathing in air that has very fine, sharp bits of silica. And it's cutting apart your lungs.
And then they came home to what? Squalor, right?
To a home that was built very hastily. Mining towns were not built to last like an agricultural community. So we have largely wooden structures. If they had windows, they would be very thin, single-paned, trying to get access to clean water and to warmth, adequate sanitation, and sewage would be a struggle. Even just snow removal is a struggle. And so, you know, you think of the women who were in the home with the children, trying to feed the children and keep them warm, you know, preventing the spread of disease. It was a clawing your way to survival each day. And I can't imagine what that felt like.
Life at 10,000 feet. I mean, it was brutally cold, I'm sure.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, we have maybe 6 weeks between heavy frosts up here, trying to get healthy food at that time. I mean, would be a struggle, and then can you afford it?
Well, and a lot of them were just escaping the potato famine.
Right.
So they were on their heels.
Absolutely, and didn't come with many resources. You know, they say it's hard to live up in Leadville now. I can't imagine 140 years ago.
Well, the Irish did try. They tried to unionize. They tried to get better conditions. Was it Mike? Talk about Michael Mooney.
Michael Mooney, you know, was definitely a very young and dynamic leader in trying to get the unions organized in Leadville. They were not successful, unfortunately.
What year was
the major
that?
Strikes. There was strike in 1883, I want to say. Could be 1880. So in the 1880s and the 1890s is when they were forming, becoming what they wanted to be a very legitimate, legitimately recognized union, and present as peacefully and as a legitimate is just the word that keeps coming to mind.
Right.
And they were not recognized by the mine owners. The mine owners would not sit down with them. They would not listen to their demands. They were completely dismissed.
Well, you talked earlier about Butte, and Butte, the conditions were much better.
The conditions were better in Butte, and I think that looking at the way in which the owners of the mine or mines, how they allied themselves with the workers would definitely tell the story.
Right. The owner in Butte was an Irish Catholic.
There you go.
Initially.
Yep. And that makes a big difference between...
Yeah. He had fealty to the miners.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that that then has ripples for the union history of Colorado, you know, of how it played out.
Talk about that.
Well, I think that... there's always been a tension between the owners of the means of production and those who actually produce it to be able to unionize for things which are of fundamental safety issues and quality of life issues. And that the miners were put down with the support of the National Guard indicates clearly siding against them and their treatment during and after the strikes, if they participated, short of losing their lives, being kicked out of town, chained up and put on chain gangs, their families being deported out of town if they were found to be associated with, if their worker, if their dad, uncle, whatever, was associated with the strike, they would be removed as well. And so it was a wholesale cleaning out of whatever the rabble could be identified. And so you add to that struggle to a culture of fear.
Well, and you know, a lot of these miners were seeing their children and their wives die.
Absolutely.
And their fellow workers in the mines die.
Yeah.
And which resulted in people being buried at the pauper's grave.
Absolutely. If you look at the pauper's graves that are in Evergreen Cemetery, there's a Protestant section and a Catholic section. So the churches would bury the body of those who were too poor to afford the $15 for a grave. And if you're making $3 a day and your main wage earner just died, there's no way that you would have that much money saved up for a burial. So the Catholic Church would bury them for free. Ironically, in reading an article with the groundskeeper of the cemetery, he would try to dig about 150 graves by the end of October before the ground froze.
Wow.
And then he felt like he'd be in pretty good shape to last him through the spring. Because, of course, the ground freezes hard, and it's you would have to build a fire. When my grandmother was buried, they built a fire on top to melt the earth so that we could dig out the grave. So he would dig them ahead of time. At this time, you know, dissection and trying to learn about physiology of the body was very new, and there were grave robbing was common. But according to the article of this man, the Catholic Church had an agreement with the doctors in town that they could have these paupers' bodies as long as they returned whatever was left and buried it. And so it is a pretty stark indicator of the value of their life.
Yes.
Right? It also then explains why more than a quarter of the graves out there are shared by more than one person.
So how many people, I mean, it's been estimated, yeah. but what can yep. you...
Right. So thanks to the incredible data collection by James Walsh and his graduate students of the records kept by the Catholic Church, just in the Catholic free section, and it's called Catholic free because it was free to Catholics, not free of Catholics. It's actually full of Catholics. In the Catholic free section, there's 1,323 names that they've identified. And if you think about that, we've sort of did the rough math of about the 13 years that the cemetery was open, it's about a burial every 3 days. And of course, there would be more during the scarlet fever or smallpox epidemics. And at the time, Leadville had 30,000 people or so.
When did you first realize the pauper's grave? Was that something you knew early on in your life? Or
you know, we used to go down there as kids because my grandparents' house was nearby, and it was just sort of a fun place to knock around in the cemetery.
Right.
And it wasn't until I met Jim Walsh and we talked about sort of our shared passion for the Irish, specifically in Leadville, and I took him out on a walk to that cemetery, and I was like, I gotta show you these graves because they're really cool. And he's the one who then sort of had that lightning moment and realized he needed to learn more about them, and he spent... you know, hours and hours at the Catholic Church, slept on the couch in the rectory, researching the handwritten records that they had. And slowly he literally unearthed, you know, what was the demographic? How many were Irish? How many were just from the Barra Peninsula in Ireland? And how many were so very young? You know, the oldest one we found is Adolf Strapper, 88 years old. And then again, on the other end of the spectrum, you know, over 130 or so stillborn.
You said that you played in that area in the cemetery, mm-hmm. but you didn't really understand the significance of it until when?
I think that probably within the last 20 years, I've started. You know, after I completed my master's, I got a greater understanding of what an incredible keystone Leadville was in the development of Colorado, which was a keystone in the development of the West. And so when we would go out to the cemetery, and it's counterintuitive, when you're out there at the paupers' graves, you see the holes in the ground and then a pile of rocks next to them. And I always thought as a child, the pile of rocks was the grave where they had been piled up and put over the body. In fact, it's the depression where the pine box was and it has eroded and fallen in. The rocks around it are just all the rocks that were taken out in digging of the graves. And so... you know, I was so careful to not walk on what I thought were the graves. Ends up, I was walking right in the middle of them. And so, you know, I've asked for a little bit of forgiveness for the friends who are in the ground. And being around the cemetery, it never felt scary to me. And now, after the hundreds and hundreds of hours we've spent out there with working on the Irish Miners Memorial, and our daughters have been out there with us a long time. It does not feel like an uncomfortable or menacing place. It is, especially because I think the intent of the volunteers and the donors has been to literally bring their names to life and to light and to recognize them again, that the intention helps it be a sweet place of solace, maybe.
Yeah. I mean, it's a very sacred place.
It is.
So when you first took James Walsh there, you knew what this was, but he wasn't really aware.
Right. I mean, and we had both been doing studies of Leadville history, and I think that what that brings to light is you can't study it if it's not there. And so what really then he has done is studied what was the absence of this record of these people and where are the records and bringing that to light. And, you know, that same analogy could be played out for women, you know, or Native Americans or any group that isn't written about in history.
Right, the invisible.
So the responsibility is to try to find the invisible and tell their story. And that is, I think, why the memorial can be such a transcendent place, because it's not just about the Irish, it's not just about the Catholics. It can be about lost children, it can be about lost opportunity, it can be about domestic violence, it can be about racism. So many of those themes are present in the people who we have learned about.
Yeah.
That it really can connect to anybody with wherever they are mentally when they're coming to that. It also is a place of hope. I see a lot of my students, former students, walking their newborn babies in carriages up and down the spiral, and it's one of their favorite things to do. And we take our students out there and ask them to point to a person who's the same age of you. And that's a pretty powerful experience.
A lot of these people left Ireland and were never heard of again.
Yeah.
So the Irish never knew where their people ended up because it wasn't a time. Can you speak to that?
Absolutely. So many people were forced out of Ireland due to the successive famines and the conditions there. And often when they left to the United States, they may not have been heard from again. If they were able to read and write, to be able to have the chance to write a letter home would be minimal. They just were never heard from again. So I think that what's really amazing is to go to Ireland and speak to people there who have great-grandparents who've just been lost. They don't know where they're at. And what I think is so exciting about this project is that we can find them their people. And so I've been able to meet with descendants of the people buried in the paupers' graves and not just say, yes, they're here, but we can go to the exact plot where they're buried.
Tell me a story.
It's goosebumps, right? So last August, we were working on some final last minute landscaping out at the memorial before the big unveiling.
The unveiling was just
the unveiling last September.
Last September,
yes.
Right.
And we had about a week before the ambassador came, so it's time to get in the landscaping and get the panels up.
The Irish
up.
Ambassador.
Exactly. I mean, it was such a wonderful, wonderful deal. So we were getting everything finalized. And a family came up and was sort of watching us work. And I introduced myself, and the man mentioned that he had found all of his great-grandparents but one. And he thought his great-grandmother was here, but he wasn't quite sure. And thanks to the research that Jim Walsh has done and been able to create a spreadsheet of all of the paupers, their age, their names, where they were born, what their occupation was, any of that information that was captured is now available digitally. We were able to pull up a phone and look for Anna Welch, his great-grandmother, and then we could use the maps of the cemetery and we could walk there and find where she was. So they are now able to create a headstone and mark her. And ironically, she was one of the shared graves. So there was already a marker there for somebody else.
Wow.
And so we'll have to stagger them. But to be able to find your people and bring that closure is such a tremendous honor and gift.
Yeah, that's amazing. You just went to Ireland.
We did. My family finally, my husband and my two daughters, we were able to spend 2 weeks in Ireland, largely in the Barra Peninsula.
Wow, so you were...
Yeah, we were Al-Hillies, in the mines, exactly,
you?
In Alahees. Yes, we spent 8 days in Alahees working with our friends there. Leadville has twinned and is a sister city with Alahees. And so part of that is connecting our mining museums. We each have a mining museum connecting the schools, and really strengthening that bond that we never even knew existed. You know, Alahis and that whole Bear Peninsula, they're very familiar with how many of their people came to Butte. And Butte has been a very well-known connection.
Right.
But the connection to Leadville is newer, really, with the arrival of Jim's research. And so spending time there and taking in the vistas and thinking, this was the view in the memory of our people in Leadville. They would look out on the Skelligs. They would walk these roads. You know, they would look at the stone fences and the famine rows of where the potatoes were grown. And that was in their memory, and now it's in mine.
That was Kathleen Fitzsimmons. Kathleen's recent trip to Leadville's sister city, Alahis, was a sacred journey. In 1884, just as silver was beginning to boom in Leadville, the brutal copper mines of Alahis were closing. Those mine closures forced hundreds of Irish miners to leave Ireland and look for a better life in Leadville, Colorado, and Butte, Montana. Unfortunately, for many of them, their journey was what some have called a trail of tears. Many of these young Irish men and their families were never heard from. The Leadville Irish Miners Project has given names to the nameless and the disappeared. Thanks to Kathleen Fitzsimmons and James Walsh, and to all of the volunteers, both here and in Ireland, who have worked countless hours to honor the true heroes and victims of the Industrial Revolution. You've been listening to Immigrant Stories. For more on Immigrant Stories, please go to our website, immigrantstories.net. You can find us on Facebook and on Apple Podcasts. Thanks for listening.